underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In 2011, Greg Iles sustained life-threatening injuries in a car accident on Highway 61 near Natchez, Mississippi. He remained in a medically induced coma for 8 days and ultimately lost part of his right leg. Doctors declared his survival miraculous. Out of that tragedy, the Natchez Trilogy was born. The Natchez Trilogy has been compared to Faulkner and Conroy, the greatest Southern Gothic writers. The themes in the trilogy include race issues in the South, past and present, the legacy of a father, small-town relationships, and unattainable love. The Natchez Trilogy includes Natchez Burning and The Bone Tree. The culmination of the trilogy is the new book, Mississippi Blood, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Greg Iles to this week's book show. Greg, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here, Joe.
Very nice to have you with us. Give us a sense of when you take on a project like this, even at what point you realized that this was going to be huge and it would ultimately be a trilogy, something that you would be working on for many years.
You know, the gut check, Joe, came when I initially planned to write it as a first as a standalone novel. I was on that hamster wheel of writing best-selling novels one a year. And because I was writing about race in the South and family, I pretty quickly started to realize that one standard novel was not going to contain it. And I was going into discussions with my publisher about that around the time I had the accident. And when I came out of that coma, that was really the Saul on the road to Damascus moment. I realized I wasn't going to be around forever, and we're not given that many chances to say what we want to say. So I just stopped caring about the commercial exigencies, and pretty quickly I had to change agents and lost my publisher and kind of started back at ground zero. And at that point, I realized it might take up to 3 books, and of course it inevitably did. And I was 5 years off the shelf before Natchez Burning, you know, was released.
And in that 5 years, was that work just on that book or really on the whole project?
Primarily that book. You know, let's see, the time separation really would go from the Devil's Punch Bowl just prior to the accident till after. But most of that work was on the first book, and yet I certainly thought I saw my way to the end within that period. So even though the whole thing would end up taking 7.5 years, most of the work was on the first one. I feel strange saying that because I come from a tradition of having to produce a book a year, whereas some of my competitors like Thomas Harris, you know, he took 7 years to write Red Dragon or Silence of the Lambs. Right. Donna Tartt took 7 years to write The Secret History. For me, even 2 years is a luxury. But coming close to dying, let me say, you know what, I'm going to take however long I need.
With that, does it change? I mean, obviously, when you have an experience like that, it changes everything, I would assume. It changes who you are fundamentally in ways. So does it change you as a writer? Did it change you as give you even more freedom, it sounds like, to explore these things?
You know, I tend to write the kind of books, the cliche would be, it's the kind of book you have to wait for certain people to die before you can write the book. Coming close to death myself, I think, it didn't necessarily change me as a writer in terms of words going onto the page. What it changed was where I drew my own censorship, my own filter. I decided I just couldn't afford to worry about how it was received in my hometown, in my home state. No, I didn't let any of those, in my own family, I didn't let any of those things stop me from going where the story needed to go. And that was a change from previous books.
And so to ask that question in just another way, because I used the word freeing, I mean, did you feel that there was a point that you could really explore whatever you wanted to and take as long, and that was a freedom that you hadn't had before?
Yes, although you never get the freedom that you could just take as long as you need. I mean, in publishing, all writers know this. It's a business, and you will never have the freedom that you really want to take as long as you want. So don't get the idea that I freed myself and I thought, well, when it's done, it's done. The entire time I felt under phenomenal pressure to finish. And of course, I was under the imperative of having to find a new publisher and really build back from zero. So I had gone from my previous book being number one in paperback to not having a publisher and owing back a massive advance and having to find a new publisher. So it was a struggle on many fronts.
Greg Iles is our guest. The new novel in this series is Mississippi Blood and concludes the Natchez Burning trilogy. Let us talk for a moment about this character, Penn Cage, and what you felt there was to explore with this man, and chiefly with the relationship between this man and his father.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to be up front, Joe, and say Penn Cage for me was never intended to be a series character, number one. Number two, he was always more of an observer than a action hero thriller character. His first book was in 1998. I waited 7 years to do another. But as I returned more to Southern themes and my hometown, Penn was just a good agent and observer to present what I wanted to. Now, I bring this up because people have been comparing me to Pat Conroy. I got to meet Pat in the year before he died and have some email exchange with him. And one thing I figured out was that a lot of writers write in opposition to or almost in reverence of their fathers. This trilogy is Tom Cage's book more than Penn Cage's book, I think. It's his story. And I think Conroy tended to write in opposition to or to understand a father who didn't love him or didn't know how to show love. And the son was never sure if his father loved him. I was the son of a father who absolutely did love me and was beloved in his community by his patients, by the townspeople. So the shock for me was to, at a certain age, come to realize my father was not the saint that a lot of people saw him as. And that's really the genesis of these books. One critic put it the best when they said, imagine Jim Finch grew up to learn things about Atticus that no son should ever know about his father. Mm-hmm. To me, that says what this trilogy is about.
And you have described the character of Tom Cage as Atticus Finch with the stethoscope.
Yeah, I would. That's pretty close, yeah.
So in this book, Dr. Tom Cage is being tried for the murder of his African-American nurse. When you say that this is really the book about him, but it is also very much about that relationship between father and son.
Yeah, the book really happens on two levels. On one level, it's the familial story of secrets. It's about where the races meet, where the black and white races come together secretly in the South, and that's emblematic of the whole country, but particularly the South. And then, of course, the second level of the book is the sort of epic tapestry background that is there that is based upon real-life civil rights murders that happened in my area. And those two, you know, the familial story, I think, is what pulls people in, and it's the through line of this sort of epic tale, which totals 2,300 pages. I don't want to scare people because it sounds like something too ponderous to read. It's not, you
no.
know. But the reason it's so big is because of that second story, really.
It seems that whenever I talk to an author who has written a trilogy, they always say that the second one was the hardest. Was that the case for you?
Yeah, and it's for a simple reason. And I found myself stumbling on a new analogy yesterday. I was on ESPN, of all things, and I reached for a sports metaphor, and this describes it. Imagine I'm writing a trilogy based upon one of the most famous football games in the world.
Right.
Natchez Burning was the first two quarters. You have a great beginning. You end with sort of a great little mini resolution. But the middle book is like nothing but the third quarter. You don't have the beginning. You don't have the ending. That's a tough sell for anybody. Even when they're thinking about buying it, it's like, okay, I'm not sure I read the first one. I'm not going to find the solution to the mystery. Now, Mississippi Blood, thank God, is all fourth quarter and overtime. So finally we're there. We've come home, you know.
But there were so many things that were introduced in The Bone Tree that the whole idea of the double eagles and this offshoot of the KKK and that sustained that and made it riveting that made you want to stick around for the fourth quarter.
Well, I hope so. I think for the real readers who really are there for what I say is the right reason and not just pure escapism, yeah, The Bone Tree is very rich. And I've had to sort of shut down the questions into the Kennedy assassination and all that because people ask so often about that. But a lot of what's in The Bone Tree is based on reality. And I get that question a lot, you know, how real are these books? And I will just say the background stuff, the flashbacks to the 60s and all that stuff is very, very real. It's only the modern-day stuff that's exaggerated to a degree.
So then when you come to this book and come to Mississippi Blood, this features a trial scene that is just amazing. And I'm curious as to what it was like for you. I mean, obviously you knew this was coming. You had to write it. And for how you get ready to do something like that, and did it take longer than normal, or was it a very natural process?
The dramatic part of it was natural for me, but I'm not an attorney, and so it involved a little more heavy lifting. Now, I want to credit my band member in the Rock Bottom Remainder, Scott Turow, who I just admire beyond measure. And I also like to credit a book from, I believe, the 1950s, Anatomy of a Murder by Robert Traver. You know, writing a trial for me is a minefield because if you think about the legal thriller genre, it is so saturated. Readers have read so many trials that are melodramatic that you just don't want your scenes to even remind people of those books. So that really was the thing, to be able to keep it different, to pull readers along and not have them feel that, oh, I've been here 1,000 times before. So I hope I did that.
And I assume that's for you as well, that you don't want to write anything that seems like that you have read before, that you are familiar
Absolutely.
With.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There are certain high water marks, like a book I think people don't appreciate enough is a novel called Word of Honor by Nelson DeMille that involves a war crime in Vietnam that sort of erupts in the present. And DeMille served in Vietnam. And I think that's why that book is so resonant and so powerful. One of the greatest legal thrillers and novels ever written, I think. And for me, that was what I was aiming for, to achieve that kind of impact and catharsis when you're reading the trial scenes.
Our guest is Greg Iles. The new book is Mississippi Blood. It is published by William Morrow. I do want to talk a little bit about this idea of being a Southern writer and what that means. I'm interested because I've heard people completely dismiss it out of hand, but I believe Pat Conroy actually embraced it quite a bit.
Well, anybody who dismisses it out of hand obviously doesn't know what they're talking about, or they're in denial about it, you know. Being a Southern writer, it's certainly a established tradition. I'm proud to say I'm from Mississippi, and I came from Ole Miss, where I studied under Willie Morris. And I can tell you, alumni of that same program are Donna Tartt, who won the Pulitzer, and an array of writers stretching to John Grisham. But all you have to do is go back to Faulkner, Tennessee Williams, or whatever. Now, people frequently say, oh, is it something in the water? Is it, you know, they have these trick questions. But I think I know what the answer is. My first agent had a theory. She was a Yankee, and her theory was great suffering produces great art, and people in the South are suffering. So I'm not sure I buy that. But here's what I think it is. America has changed profoundly over the last century and a half. You've had the migration to the cities, especially away from the agricultural regions. And in the South, okay, if I get off the interstate anywhere in the country and I'm on book tour, everywhere looks just about the same. I don't care where I get off. There's a P.F. Chang and a Bonefish Grill and a mall meant to look like America in 1910. Mm-hmm. When you get off the interstate in Mississippi, the one interstate going north to south or at the bottom, you know you're somewhere, Joe. It's Mississippi. It's a place. It's in every molecule of the air. And it's not a melting pot of 100 races. You got black folks, you got white folks, and that's pretty much it. You get down in the low, low numbers, you have some Latinos and Asians. But it is a crucible of race relations, and it's symbolic of the entire country. So everything in Mississippi and the Deep South is in starker relief. And those, certainly in the age we live in, and going back into the early 20th century, race is the most empirically important issue in the country. So I think that's why, that's what it means to be a Southern writer, to embrace place and to write stories that literally probably couldn't happen anywhere else.
So there is one way of doing that, of course, and that is to hold up a mirror and allow us to see that. You go further than that, it seems to me, in these books, and not only showing us what the South is like and this place where that you are a product of, but also to very much explore it and to look under the rocks.
My message, and I hope these books help get that across, is that the South has always been the whipping boy for the nation on race, particularly Mississippi has been that. Americans have always said, oh, isn't it terrible how bad racism is down there in Mississippi, down there in Alabama? And that is a big American cop-out, because the only difference between the North and the South is this. Racism in the South is overt. It always has been. It's not hypocritical. It's right there on the street. In the North, it's covert, but it's there. And if the political events of the last year and a half, 3 years, have shown us anything, it is that racism is not a distinctly sectional problem. It's not a Southern problem. It's an American problem. These shootings, these police-involved shootings, the protests, they're not happening in Selma, Alabama, or Natchez, Mississippi. They're happening all over the country. And what you learn when you study this period, let me make one little digression. In 1964, when Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman went missing, one of the biggest hunts in the world in American history started to find the missing civil rights workers. On about day 19, I believe, two bodies washed up in an offshoot of the Mississippi River on the other side of the state. For 12 hours, communications went crazy between Jackson, Mississippi, the field office of the FBI, and Washington, D.C. Then it was discovered that the two boys who washed up in the river were both black, Dee and Moore. At that point, attention receded, the spotlight went back to Neshoba County, and it was 40 years before the murders of Dee and Moore were solved. Now, did it take 40 years because people in Mississippi were apathetic? Maybe they were apathetic, but they were just as apathetic in Washington and in New York and in Los Angeles, okay? Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman drew that attention because two of them were white civil rights working students from the North. So these problems of racism and apathy and misunderstanding are nationwide, and we're going to have to deal with it in that way if we're going to solve that problem. And I hope these books help to make that clear.
Talk to me, and I don't know at what book you where you say this, but you make a point at one point of talking about Natchez, of being a small city, but being very much unlike the rest of Mississippi. How so?
Well, that's pretty easy to answer. You know, Natchez, I believe, is the oldest continuous settlement on the Mississippi. It got very wealthy long before the Mississippi Delta, which is known as sort of the cradle of the cotton economy. In 1850, Natchez had more millionaires than anywhere in the country except Philadelphia and New York. The sons and daughters of the Natchez Nabobs, as they call them, were educated at Harvard and Yale. The girls were sent to the courts in Europe, royal courts. So this was a wealthy, educated, and far more liberal place. You know, the bars have always been open 24 hours a day, while the rest of Mississippi suffered under blue laws and religious fundamentalism. Natchez surrendered at the very beginning of the Civil War, so its antebellum mansions were never destroyed. It's just very, very different. Now, after World War II, the character changed a little bit because several plants opened up and a lot of workers were brought in from the outlying counties. That became the raw material from which the Ku Klux Klan recruited quite successfully, to the point that the largest KKK meeting ever held in the United States happened 1 mile from my house when I was 5 years old. So you have Natchez is a town of contradictions. You have old gentility, the remains of a lot of money, but it's shrinking now. And, you know, last year I worked to run communications for the black mayoral candidate who won with 90% of the vote in a 50-50 split town. That's pretty unique in Mississippi. So it's unique in a lot of ways.
And yet it still has all of those fibers that we were discussing earlier about the South, and that allows you to explore these issues of racism and surrounds it in a very pure way.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I could, as Faulkner said, you start writing about your own little postage stamp of native soil.
Right.
And he discovered that he could never exhaust the possibilities of that one little postage stamp. And I've learned the same thing. There are an infinite number of stories there, and there's a long way to go. I'm not sure I'll go right back with my next book, but there's certainly more to tell.
Which brings us to that bugger of a question, which is, what do you do next after you're done a trilogy like this? And,
well,
and
you know,
what direction you go into?
It's an interesting question because my inclination, I'm very tired. You know, when I began this, I felt young. My kids were in middle school, beginning high school. I had both legs. Now that I've finished this, I have one leg. My kids are in college or graduating college, and I'm starting to look like Santa Claus. I'm ready for a little rest. I'm tempted to take on something a little lighter. You know, I was planning a book, sort of a film noir, Double Indemnity type story set in Oxford, Mississippi. But out on the road, I've learned I'm really being treated different, and I've seen that this trilogy has really been accepted or seen as something more than a thriller, what I've done in the past. And I realize that people really are paying attention, and sales seem to indicate that. And I wonder, rather than take a breath and do something less, if I should just recharge my batteries and use this chance I've been given to continue to mine this vein I'm in now. I'm not sure, really.
And does it help, and is it reassuring that you have developed characters that appear in these books that I assume you would like to acquaint yourself with again?
It's almost like you don't have a choice about it. I don't want to sound like the pretentious writer, but, you know, those who still survive, I don't want to give any spoilers, but those who survive, they now live in my imagination and the imagination of readers. And in a sort of Jungian sense, they're present in me. They're real. And boy, did I ever learn in the second book, when you kill a character, there's a price to be paid. I have met some angry readers out on the road this time. So people get very, very invested in these characters, much more than I ever suspected.
Well, Greg Iles' new novel is Mississippi Blood. It concludes the Natchez Burning trilogy. It is published by William Morrow. Greg Iles, a great pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you very much for taking time with us.
Thanks, Joe. Great to be here, man.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.